welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, and right off the top, I want to send a shout-out to some potential new listeners over in the OVC cafeteria who saw our wonderful spotlight in the Guelph Today and said, hey, you're on the radio. I said, yeah, you should listen. Thursdays at 5, every Thursday. So, welcome, new listeners.
Guelph Today famous.
Yes.
That was something that happened over the break.
Yeah.
Check it out. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, but not this week, though. This week, we're just going to be talking about the news, including the Australian wildfires. We can all agree that fire is bad, but what about the response, and what about the Australian government's difficult relationship in accepting climate change is real? And then the trial of Harvey Weinstein, that got underway this week. But will this be a watershed moment people are hoping it will be? And what about those new charges in LA? And then finally, the hereditary chiefs of Wet'suwet'en are getting ready for another fight with Coastal GasLink. But is this a reconciliation failure, or are the chiefs tilting at windmills? So our first topic this week, we almost kicked off the decade with a new endless war in the Middle East. So
oh my goodness.
That was a near miss. But I mean, the more important, well, maybe the more important Canadian angle to this story was the Ukrainian plane that was now shot down, they're saying. That was the...
I know that was an evolving story this afternoon. Does it seem like it's official?
Well, Justin Trudeau came out and said that multiple intelligence agencies have said it was
okay,
shot down.
Okay, so I was working this afternoon trying to tune in.
Yeah, has affected us here on the University of Guelph campus. There were two PhD students whose names I'm going to butcher now. Gonsmet Asardi and Milad Ghazimi Ariani. Who were PhD students here at the University of Guelph were amongst the victims. And Justin Trudeau did a conference earlier this afternoon that confirmed reports that were coming out that U.S. intelligence agencies were confirming that the plane was shot down, that it was not a mechanical failure, although that seemed unlikely. It was not human error, because that also seemed unlikely given the track record of the pilots. So...
And the fact that it was a Boeing, too, right away was... obviously not the planes that have been crashing.
Right. It's a solid plane. It wasn't a 737 MAX. People who might have been alluding to that online were mistaken. It was a 737, different line of planes. So the plane itself was solid. And it had recently had a maintenance check, too. So,
and sadly, just after the missile attack, when this happened, I thought, I hope this isn't like the Malaysian Airlines plane that went down in Donetsk in 2011, which was the same kind of thing, a plane flying in what is potentially, although it turns out in Iran, currently not necessarily a war zone. In Donetsk, it's been a back and forth for years and years and years. That was in 2011 now, I think, so eight years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, it would seem that that's the case. So this makes everything 10 times worse. And initially... it was like, you know, you're sort of hoping that this is going to sound terrible. If it was a plane load of American, like passport carrying American people, this war would already be in full bore. Mm-hmm. The fact that it wasn't. And believe me, if I hear anybody saying again that, well, they're not real Canadians, I'm coming for you. Okay. That's mm-hmm. just off the top. As you said, two people in our community. And it turns out the dentist from Aurora that perished in the crash, spent some time at a practice in the South End.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more than one Guelph connection. And because of the size of the Iranian community in Canada, not just in the GTA, the odds are really good that most people are connected to someone who was on this plane, both those that are dual citizens. And Iran doesn't recognize dual citizenship, which is causing some issues with what has happened. But also it would seem that other people are on the plane. It sounds like the majority of the Iranian people were coming to Canada via this plane. What was it that Trudeau said? 138 empty seats on that one plane?
Yeah.
So they were pretty much all, not everybody, the majority of the people on the plane were coming here.
I mean, some of them were students who, you know, were going back for the break. Some of them were, you know, like people who have permanently settled here or were dual citizens.
Yeah.
Who, you know, of course, go home for the holidays, home being Iran. Yeah, and it's also highlighted like a fairly big hole in our foreign affairs department, which is we don't have a diplomatic mission in Iran.
No, it was cut off by Harper and a Huff.
Back in 2012, what was the whole like, oh, you guys, you know, they're funding terrorism, and like basically following the typical party line of the neocon set. And it's just, you know, unfortunately, you don't really think about these things until something like this happens. But it does like seem like a really huge oversight, especially when, you know, you have the Trudeau government coming to power in 2015. Like also that year you have the JCPOA. And that would have seemed like the time to say, like, it was starting with, like, I don't want to say a clean slate, but a cleanish slate.
Yeah. You can always reset, right?
Right. But, it, you know, now it looks like a really huge oversight that, you know, Trudeau's been in power for over 4 years now. And, you know, diplomatic relations with Iran have not been addressed. And then you also think particularly of the fact that there's a pretty large Iranian-Canadian community.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be some representation. There should be some sort of back and forth.
And I think, sadly, in some roundabout way, that this may result in that. Because it's obviously an evolving story, and we're not even sure what's happening at this minute. But they obviously have to establish some kind of diplomatic connection to sort through this. And there's many, many parties involved, from the Ukrainians, anybody that had a hand in, or I believe in plane crashes, anybody who has citizens on board that plane are involved in the investigation. But of course, I don't think it works in terms of majority rule. But obviously, the Canadian government are going to be very involved, not just in the investigation, but as you know, as you were saying, the diplomatic. It's not really a dance. The diplomatic back and forth that's going to have to go on,
right,
because of this, and you know, and one would hope, as I said off the top of there, I mean, the American response would have been more. It is so unfortunate that this came about, you know, right after this, the missile strike, which is what we were initially going to talk about. It seems like the Americans got a heads up on it. They were able to go into bunkers like this missile strike.
Well, the Iraqis got the heads up, and then the Iraqis gave the Americans a heads up.
So was it seems were able to save face. The Iranians were able to go, look, see, we hit them back. The Americans, or Trump in particular, was like, okay, they stood down, as these Iraqis were middlemen. And I believe there were some puzzled Kurds as well. I think one of the missiles went into Kurdistan. They're kind of like, why is this coming here? But it sounds like it was a bit of a show in terms of pinpoint accuracy. But of course, that's all negated when a plane load of innocent civilians goes down. And initially, when they'd said a Ukrainian plane, I thought for sure this was the NATO soldiers either getting out or...
And I mean, because there were some... The two bases that were targeted, Canadian soldiers were staying there. And the Canadians and the Germans
had been
bugged out earlier, unrelated to the missile attack or being tipped off about the missile attack. But the NATO soldiers who are there conducting, you know, troop training and exercises and things in the wake of the escalation were being moved out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't separate the whole thing that's happened in the last week. And first of all, the killing of Soleimani.
Yes. That started at the beginning, yes. Because that was the kickoff.
A drastic overreaction to... to even go further than that, there was an attack on American contractors, and there was a rocket attack that was retaliation to that, which then spurned this protest sort of vandalism in front of the U.S. consulate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was around New Year's Eve or just before New Year's Eve. And, of course, Donald Trump comes out and says, like, this is not going to be at Benghazi, because that's where his mind goes. Think about the worst thing that happened to Barack Obama, and that's the worst thing that can happen to him. And then... So they had to retaliate in some way. And the story goes that the advisors brought him a list of options. On them was assassinating Qasem Soleimani.
And he'd be like, go for it.
And the assumption was, like, assassinating Soleimani is on the far outer edge of responses. And there are several more proportional responses before we get there. But we're going to put this on the outside to show you where the edge is. And of course, he goes right to the edge.
Oh, of course.
It's like, kill that guy, boom, yeah. And I was watching an interview with John Kerry last night, former Secretary of State John Kerry.
Yep.
He was on Lawrence O'Donnell, and O'Donnell said, you know, did when you were Secretary of State, was there ever an option to kill Soleimani. And Sean Kerry's like, it was always an option to kill Soleimani.
Yeah, they have their hit list,
right?
It's
always been on
the
table. Yeah. But, you know, it's like killing the Secretary of Defense of the United States. It's like that kind of escalative action. But, of course, because Donald Trump has no foreign policy experience, has no military experience. His only experience is to act tough and act now and think about the consequences later. Immediately went to this and ratcheted up an escalation. And by no means is Iran like blasting an empty base meant to be seen as like restraint on their part, because
it's sending a message.
It's sending
a
message.
Here you go. This is what.
I mean, it gives them a chance to show off, like, look how restrained we are as compared to you-know-who over where.
Yeah.
But, of course, Iran doesn't want to be put in the situation that Iraq was put in, where you had Saddam Hussein, great saber rattler, great boogeyman, but at the end of the day, he had nothing.
Those Scud missiles were
just
kind of...
And it's in the back of the Iranian's mind, this gets too far ahead, we're done.
Well, because they said it was unprecedented in that, okay, the missile attack itself, tit for tat, wasn't.
Yeah.
But the fact that they said, we're going to do this. If you retaliate to this, we're going to bomb Israel and we're going to bomb, I think they said Damascus.
Yeah.
They picked those two places and said, if you respond to this, so this is their way of, it's kind of laying the gauntlet down.
And Yemen too, where like the big U.S.
And
bases are.
It's like, we're just going to go for it. And then Trump somehow pulls it back and says, oh, it looks like they're standing down. So it's not,
right.
I mean, you would almost say that everybody wins. The people, how many was it? 56 who died in the stampedes during the funeral are not winners.
No.
The people on the Ukrainian plane.
No.
Which is still very much, you know, on the front burner. That, I really don't know where that's going to go. Because it's us, because it's Canada, I think the response is obviously going to be way more measured. But as I'd said, I think it may be an opportunity for the two countries and other players to reestablish those ties that have been broken. I think that's where it's going to go. Can't say with certainty, but you know, we can only hope, because we don't need a
conflict
with Iran.
Canada doesn't have the capability to launch an attack on Iran. And at that, you know, you don't have Justin Trudeau going on Twitter and saying, like, if Iran doesn't cut it out, we're going to, you know, bomb 52 of their sites and pay back for, like, their cultural heritage sites, world cultural heritage sites, I should add.
Because that's not how Canada rolls. But they could potentially, under NATO or the auspices of something else, say, look, we need to, you know... They could escalate it. I'm saying they, but I really mean we, like our government. But I don't know, at least I don't think it's going to go there.
Right.
And if it was the States or maybe any of the other players, it would be a completely different story.
And the thing of it is, too, I mean, the whole situation is highlighted. What is like a, and Spencer Ackerman wrote a really great piece in the Daily Beast about how the war on terror was kind of always going here, where... In essence, America has become addicted to war. They are chasing the high of war. And
that's very true.
Of, you know, if anyone who's an addict will tell you, each new high is not as good as the high before it. And that's where we're kind of at now. And I have little doubt that if the United States wanted to go full hog regime change in Iran, it could be done, but it'll be another Iraq situation. It'll be another Afghanistan situation.
Hundreds of thousands of people.
But I mean, aside from that, it's just like the war would be done in a month, but it would be there for 20 years and counting.
Yeah.
And this is the crux of this situation is that there's a generation of kids from the moment they're born to where they are right now, who all they've known is America at war.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean a cold war. I mean a shooting war in places in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that's tough to wrap your head around. And it was this close to starting round three. I don't mean World War III. I mean the third never-ending war in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the impulsiveness and the impetuousness of a man who...
There's no filter. There's no nothing.
Well, it's not even that. It's
we should get that gaze bag guy. Get him.
Well, the crux of it is too, and we should move on to the next topic. But the crux of it is too. Donald Trump has spent 3 years telling everybody, You don't believe the intelligence agencies. They're deep staters. They're liars. They're working for the enemies of America. And by American, I mean me. And then he comes out and says, well, got to trust the intelligence agencies, don't you?
I personally, in my opinion, would pin the Ukrainian plane going down on Trump more so than I would the Iranians. You can take that to the bank. Anyway, we could probably next week we're probably going to talk about this again. So,
without
tabled until next Thursday.
Yeah, come back.
Yeah.
Okay. So, also over Christmas, there's an escalating situation in Australia with the wildfires there. I mean, obviously, fire bad. You know, to quote the old Frankenstein character from Saturday Night Live. Fire bad.
Oh, yeah.
But shouldn't laugh.
Hartman. Yeah.
Yeah. But there is a serious situation in Australia, not just about having to deal with the fires. And that is considerable. And there are a lot of issues along with that. In fact, that, you know, in a lot of these places where fires are burning, the people fighting them are volunteer firefighters. And places like Sydney, like big metropolitan places, obviously have a firefighting staff that are part of like the city. But I mean, in a lot of these rural places, the firefighters are volunteer, kind of like, you know, if you get
parts of Canada,
Perth County and, you know, the Muskoka.
Parts of around here, yes.
Yeah, that would be the same thing. So you're talking about people who have, you know, haven't been to work in weeks because they're on the front line of the fire. But the more pressing thing, too, is, or maybe not the most pressing thing at the moment, but, you know, sort of the bigger picture is the Conservative government of Australia, who have been flagrant climate change deniers. And I'm going to try and find a quote from one particular guy, but well, anyway, you pick up from where I left off.
Yeah, because, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is pretty much under the gun initially because he went off to Hawaii in the middle of all of this.
Yeah.
Cut his vacation short and came back.
That sucks.
Yeah, exactly. to an atmosphere where he's being continuously heckled by people, go up to the firefighters to shake hands. They don't want to shake hands. But this is also the guy who very famously, when he was he the, I think they call it treasurer, there'd be Minister of Finance equivalent, waving around a piece of coal in Parliament saying, this is coal. This is what fuels everything here. This is our bread and butter. I'm putting words in his mouth, but it was along those lines. Like brings a hunk of coal in to wave around saying, if I understand it right, Australia is the number one world exporter of coal. So this is their coal equals. And I meant to look up what powers their electricity and power grid. It is probably coal, right? If that's the attitude, then it's probably coal equals jobs equals all of those things. Having said that, on top of all of that is they are definitely very deep into climate change denial. And this is one of those situations where 40% is
coal generation.
40%, there you go. So that's fairly high, I mean, even compared to us. This past weekend, the cities of Sydney and Canberra, highest temperatures ever seen, ever measured. Continuous drought for years, record low precipitation. And, of course, the winds that come up. I don't know if you said these, what do they call it? The fire tornado, which will lift the fire up and place it down somewhere else. Now, this, by its design, Australia has wildfires, and that's why there are so many volunteer firefighters. And they have a rule there, if your house is at risk, you can stay and defend it. And I think people have died. Mm. What's the death toll now?
25.
25?
At least as of yesterday.
I think some of the people, but not all of them, because some of them were firefighters and volunteers, passed away defending their homes. And millions of hectares burnt. And what I saw, I've seen estimates between half a billion and a billion animals.
Mm-hmm.
Like we've obviously seen the koalas.
And they say that's conservative.
And they have schemes down there to reintroduce endangered species. Supposedly they are possibly all gone. This Kangaroo Island. It sounds like a Pelee Island type place off the coast. Is it Victoria? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Everybody's learning about Australian geography right now. But people need to know that satellite shot that's making the rounds on social media is not remotely
accurate. I'm glad you brought that up.
It is somewhat accurate, but if I understand it right, it's an artist's rendition of like total amount of fire that the country has
seen.
Month. It's not an active, here is a shot from space of Australia?
Yeah.
False.
It's not a literal ring of fire.
Let's go full Snopes here, right? Or
But there's another one. There's another map that's going around that shows people saying it's fire, but it's like representing of hot spots. So it's not places that are on fire necessarily, but places that could have the right conditions for a fire. So these pictures are going around, and I mean, it's important to sort of recognize the full extent of like how bad it is, but they're not like representational. It's not like the freaking continent's on fire. So I mean that's a very important distinction too. And to go back to the government though, I found this quote: Energy Minister Angus Taylor told the Australian that they are not going to buckle into, quote, top-down pressure from the United Nations to act on climate change. Or, excuse me, any top-down pressure from the United Nations to act on climate change would fail.
He just said this?
It must have been recent.
Yeah.
But it's...
As we burn.
As they burn. You also have, and this was reported in a Guardian article I read, that you have, like, the firefighter saying, like, don't take pictures of like taking down trees. Like, you know, they have to take down trees in order to put up, you know, to fight the fire.
And are they upset? Environmentalists will get upset.
That's what they said. Yeah. Don't take pictures of taking down trees because the quote unquote greenies will be all over us.
Of course, the Australians have great nicknames for everybody. The greenies. I can just hear.
Yeah. So, of course, this is all based in a media ecosystem. And not to sound too terribly conspiratorial, but I mean, it's true. Rupert Murdoch, because where's Rupert Murdoch from?
Oh, of course. Yes.
Australia. He is all over that country.
Mm-hmm.
The Australian, the newspaper that Angus Taylor was quoted in, is his. Sky News. But I mean, all these people are like, you know.
I don't think that's too far off.
No, it's not too far off. Like they are, you know, they're scared of. If they believe in climate change.
Yes.
No, but that's... If they believe that climate change is a thing that's happening, and they should because it is, they can't say it because they'll be picked off by the Murdoch media ecosphere. And even if they do believe that climate change is a Chinese hoax or whatever, it's because they have been, you know, broiled in that media ecosphere. It's like Fox News. I mean, the parallels are kind of uncanny because coal's a much bigger thing in Australia than it is in the United States. But, you know, look at what's happened in the United States with Donald Trump talking about how he loves coal and he wants to bring back coal. You know, in a world that is like leaving coal behind, further and further behind all the time. And it's like, it's the perfect little example. Just transplant what's happening in Appalachia in the southern United States and, you know, I guess up through like sort of the western sides of Pennsylvania, but that whole
country,
that whole corridor in the States, transplant that to Australia and you have some idea of what the media ecosphere and what the political ecosphere looks like and what people are fighting. And the whole thing with the animals too, and this has been a point made by environmentalists, is that, you know, the Australian ecosystem is so unique to the planet.
Yes.
Because it was just allowed to be on its own for millions and millions of years without human interference, without much interference from the outside world,
mm-hmm.
because it was all there, all tucked away down there.
Yeah. And an island.
So there's real loss. Let too much of this burn. There is tremendous loss. I mean, and again, this will not be fully appreciated until like the fires are out and people can like take full stock. But that billion animals number, that is birds, reptiles, and mammals. That does not include like the insects. That does not include frogs and fish and other things. Yeah. There is going to be like a serious report after this, and it's going to cause environmentalists to weep.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that can't be lost sight of as well.
No, and of course the great question is when does this all get beaten back? And a lot of it is to do with the season. I mean, that's the summer is just getting underway, right, down there, and it's
been going since September too.
Yeah, so it's not as if do we talk about this in November? I specifically remember hearing about this in November, and it's now January, and it's what do they say? The land, you know, we thought the California fires were bad in the summer. This is like eight times that. This is just 2,000 homes, probably more at this point, destroyed. It's now there was some rain, but they're saying that this weekend they're expecting. What are they calling it? It's cumulative danger, and that leads up to these conditions. But they said they're calling it a mega blaze. Mm-hmm. So they're saying that all of these things we've been talking about will come together and combine to create just one big fire. By the sounds of it, it's just going to all become potentially this weekend because conditions are going to be right. It's going to be record temperatures again, low moisture. There is no moisture. There is a cyclone going on somewhere that seems to be helping. In places, but I mean, it's big. People think of Australia as just this little thing. There was a map that sort of overlaid Australia onto the USA. It's that big.
Yeah.
And people think, oh, little Australia. And there's only 30 million? Mm. Are there not less people in Australia than there are in Canada? Because so much of it is wild, uninhabitable deserts. You know, they have the complete, the gamut of conditions there. So this
24.6 million people as of 2017.
Yeah, so it's actually less than there's less people there than in California alone. But that doesn't, you know,
less than half as many.
Yeah,
but
that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I mean the big thing is then first of all they need resources, they need money. Scotty was just pointing out the watch he doesn't have on his wrist right now.
Yes, that's the high sign there, my friend. But that's my job.
They need resources. They need money. And this is like really galling. They raised $1 billion in 24 hours when Notre Dame burned. They raised $1 billion when Notre Dame burned.
Oh, when Notre Dame burned, yes.
They have not raised that much money.
No.
For us, there's a whole continent on fire. And then you have Chris Hemsworth saying like, hey, I just gave $1 million. Anything you can do helps. I have newsflash. Chris Hemsworth is not really Thor. He can't do it all himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have like this Instagram model, Kaylin Ward, who's like, you know what? You send money to help fight the Australian wildfires. I'll send you nudes. Good hustle.
Whoa, really?
Good hustle, young lady. But, I mean,
it's not gonna
really need to reposition our priorities because when you can raise $1 billion for an 800-year-old church, you know,
put tons of lead into the atmosphere.
Right, that is always going, that will definitely, it's a World Heritage Site, it will definitely find the money, but a whole continent's on fire, and, you know, Thor is begging for some spare change.
Time to step up, billionaires that caused this. Yeah. Anyway. In my opinion.
Yes, well, good place to leave it on. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with some more news. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
That song? Do you like that song? Everybody in Canada knows that song. If you'd like to go see that song in person,
it's practically the theme music for Canada.
A version that will sound not unlike that, as this is from a two live CD set called Heavy and Mellow.
So that brings us to Harvey Weinstein, who is on trial this week, the start of his trial. Harvey Weinstein, as you know, is the disgraced movie mogul whose exposure as a degenerate rapist and assaulter.
I have alleged dirtbag written down here.
Alleged dirtbag
written down here.
Kicked off the Me Too movement in 2017 thanks to the reporting by Ronan Farrow, whose book I read over the holidays. Thank you for that, Scotty.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I expect a full review in my mailbox.
I read it cover to cover.
Excellent. I'm glad.
And yeah, so it's he's going to trial stemming from a couple of charges. But at the same time, as this court was getting underway on Monday, L.A. County came out and said they also have charges, which I don't think was a coincidence.
No, I don't know if it was waiting patiently for this to happen or what, but yeah, and it, from what I understand, the statute of limitations has run out on a lot of the accusations, so having to bring all this to the fore now is what has to happen before that changes. If I understand it right, the list is of 80 women so far, and probably that won't be the end of the list of people who have come forward. Yeah. Get this, Weinstein, who is now... showing up in a walker, and there's some questions as to whether he needs this walker or not.
He had back surgery.
We've seen this stuff before. It's like Bill Cosby goes blind, and what's his name from Egypt is in a stretcher.
Oh, and Paul Manafort too did.
Oh yeah,
was in a wheelchair. And
yeah,
I was watching news with my mom, and I was seeing Harvey Weinstein go into court with a walker, and I'm like, does he really think this is going to engender sympathy?
Yeah,
and she said, well, this was an old thing that I can't remember the name of the old mobster, but there was a guy they picked up who was connected to the mob, and he went to trial, and he was this old guy, and what he did was he would like go into court like with a walker and with a cane to try and engender sympathy with the court. I mean, so this has been an old timey thing of accused dirtbags.
I was actually thinking back to Ted Kennedy and the neck brace from Chappaquiddick, which we talked about over the holidays. But yeah, right. So there was a bit of a pattern. Now, he was in a car accident, so there... something did happen and he supposedly wrecked his back. Who cares, right? I mean, it's too bad that the car accident, in my opinion, didn't take him out. It'd be doing everybody a big favor. But I think his counsel or somebody has said, look haggard.
Yeah.
No one is going to be sympathetic to this guy considering the extent of the charges, the extent of the exposés and exposure that has happened to this story.
Yeah.
He's looking at possibly life in prison.
Yeah,
but of course, would you call this the? I wouldn't say the kickoff because we saw a little bit with Bill Cosby, who I mentioned. This was the beginning of Me Too full bore, wasn't it? Two years ago, when this all came to the fore,
right? Because he had like Megan Toohey and Jodie Cantor,
yes, who won a Pulitzer for their work,
right? And that was that wasn't as in depth as Ronan Farrow's work, but it.
Did they work in tandem on that?
Ronan Farrow was working independently on his own at NBC News, and Megan Toohey and Julie Cantor were working on a different angle that sort of led them right up to the line of going into the deeper, like long-term historical accusations that Ronan Farrow had dug up, and he sort of took the ball from there. And then, but Harvey Weinstein was the first big one, and then you get Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer Louis C.K. And then the most recent one, I think, was Les Moonves from CBS News.
Yeah, wasn't James Franco in there somewhere?
James Franco
was a bit
I mean, there's been a couple of accusations against James Franco, but there's, I mean, the thing that makes the Harvey Weinstein thing particularly savage is like the sheer force of like counter attack he was able to bring to bear. He was able to leverage his relationships as a mega donor of the New York DA's office, for example. And this is in the Cash and Kill book, is that the model Ambra Gutierrez when reported to the New York police, there's an actual SVU, Special Victims Unit. Called the Special Victims Unit even.
Yep.
And they, you know, worked with her. She wore a wire. She went in, got him to confess on the wire, putting herself in danger. And it sounded like, you know, she was in real danger when you read her story.
Yep.
So they got it. SVU gets it, goes to the New York DA's office, and they're like, hey, here's a ton of evidence. Like, let's like go arrest him. And the DA's office is like, well,
it's Harvey.
It's Harvey. And not only that, but the machine had by then like sort of had started to dirty up Gutierrez, that she was at the Bongo Bongo party that the Italian prime minister had put on. Frankly, a lot of it was slut shaming. And unjustified at that, but it was still slut shaming, because who cares if she was at a party where there were, you know, models and things.
That's how a lot of them roll. But yeah, I mean, part of it too, it'll always come up and say, why did this go on for so long?
Yeah.
And part of that story, which was covered in the New York Times, was the whole non-disclosure agreements that were put on people, are saying, we're going to settle with you. We're not, you know, disputing what you said, but you cannot say anything.
Yeah.
And that overnight, and it sounds, so there are people coming out now that are breaking these non-disclosure agreements because, you know, his house of cards is falling all around him and they don't care because now there won't be probably any repercussions to them speaking out. But secret deals and non-disclosure agreements is something that allows this to keep going on and on because he had a lot of money, can shut people up over and over and over again.
And there's, yeah.
But that has obviously completely fallen apart.
And there's also the fraternity of all this too. And that's another part that Ronan Farrow gets into is that Harvey Weinstein had cat's paws who knew about Matt Lauer. So as Ronan Farrow was like investigating this NBC News, people on Harvey Weinstein's behalf were leaning on Noah Oppenheimer, the head of NBC, saying like, hey, you know what? You pull the gun. Your boy Ronan pulls the gun on Harvey. We've got stuff that's going to pull the gun on Matt Lauer.
And then,
I mean, it all came out in the wash eventually. But still, there was this like tone of mutually assured destruction or mutually assured destruction via dirtbag. That's another thing this week. As Harvey Weinstein goes to trial this week, Matt Lauer is out with his new girlfriend. I'm like, first of all, Matt Lauer, how do you have the nerve to be out? And second of all, who is this woman who, after every allegation, especially like the one chronicled in the book of the production assistant who he raped, allegedly, I should add.
Yeah.
But still, like,
well, it's America. After
I don't know how you could read that and still go, Matt Lauer, I think we'll go out on a date. No, I would not. As a man, I would not go near Matt Lauer with a 10-foot pole.
But the level of Weinstein's hubris is massive. Like, he got in trouble from the judge for using his phone in court, which you're not supposed to do. And they say, oh, it's this misunderstanding. And he's apologized and apologized and apologized. That might seem like a minor point, but that also seems like a guy who doesn't give a crap. And something that he had said.
And then they try to get the judge booted for it.
So last month, somebody talked to him. I don't know sure what context this was, but it's been a quote that's widely shared that Harvey Weinstein saying that he feels like a forgotten man, and people have forgotten that he has made more women movies than anyone. So doesn't that make you just want to go and kick that walker out from under him? It does me. I'm like, you have a lot of nerve. No one has ever taken you to task. And I think the vast majority of people, are hoping that he goes down for a long, long time. But he's 67, supposedly, as you say, in bad health. He does not look like the healthiest specimen, but who cares? Bill Cosby's in jail. He's, what, 80?
Yeah.
You have to pay for these things. You have to pay are guilty.
Right. And that's the thing, too, is like the sheer attention of it. Like, the Bill Cosby's last trial ended in a hung jury and then goes to court, same charges, same witnesses, same information, and the court comes back with you're going to jail. The thing about the Harvey Weinstein thing is that I think he's sort of become a straw man in that, like, people can always go, like, well, that's not, like, to go to the James Franco accusations, people can go to that and say, well, it wasn't as bad as Harvey Weinstein. It's like, people don't start off as Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein is allowed to fester and grow and get more cancerous as time goes on, to the point where you do have 80-some-odd victims, right? He does feel, like, perfectly justified showing up to Daryl Hannah's hotel room in Cannes and, you know, thinking that he can, you know, do what he wants to her. Or inviting, you know, this is the thing too. I was gonna say, you know, as chronicled in Cash and Kill, you know, somebody on Harvey Weinstein's behalf befriended Rose McGowan, ingratiated themselves in her life, made her think that they were a friend and a confidant, and were funneling everything back to Harvey Weinstein and his investigators and his attorneys.
Price, right.
And I mean, so he's like the scummiest of the scummiest, allegedly. But I do want to point out this one thing, because it was sort of right under a Daily Beast post. I was reading about this, but there's a young woman named Courtney Friel, who's a weekend anchor at KTLA, and she wrote a book about dealing with her drinking problem and you know, being a TV news reporter. And in it, she talked about how she was covering the Trump campaign when she was at Fox News, and Trump called her and invited her to come visit him so that he could kiss her. And she chronicled this in the book. And last weekend...
So we could kiss. Yeah.
Yes, thank you for that.
No, but that's, yeah.
But she chronicled this in the book, and an excerpt was posted, was put in the Daily Mail. She was supposed to be anchoring the news last weekend. She's not there.
Hmm.
And some reporter, like somebody with a cell phone or something, citizen journalist, let's be generous, caught up with her at an area grocery store and like, hey, weren't you supposed to be on the news this weekend? And she's like, well, you should call KTLA and ask about that. So there's been this there's this rumor that, you know, because she was a former Fox News person who, you know, added to the kilotonnage of allegations already against Donald Trump, that, you know, she's been now paying a price. So, again, that's not necessarily true. There may be more to it. Like, who knows? But this story isn't over.
No, definitely not.
And maybe not the Harvey Weinstein portion, but not like the Me Too portion of it.
Yeah, and either. So we'll probably end up talking about it again. I should mention, you don't need to call me the correction. I do keep calling him Weinstein, but I always think of the good Weinstein, Irv Weinstein from Channel 7 News.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I find it hard to, you know, the good Weinstein versus the bad Weinstein. Allegedly dirtbag bad Weinstein.
It's amazing how many of those like Buffalo news people who like were on TV when I was growing up are like still there, because I was watching
Irv
Criminal Minds on CBS.
Had Alzheimer's for a lot of years.
And the woman who's been anchoring at 11
still
for
same.
Years, she's still there. And I'm like, good for her.
Topping tonight's Eyewitness News. I love the guy. I loved hearing about Buffalo.
Buffalo used to be... interesting.
Yeah,
now
it's coming back.
Coming back?
We'll talk about Buffalo one of these days. So. I've had some good times there.
You might be going to Buffalo.
And some bad times there.
Without
anyway.
Me. Anyway.
Do you know where your children are?
I drove
They're
through
Buffalo.
Buffalo once. Once is enough.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, so back
Judging.
In Canada. the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chiefs are making noise that despite the latest court ruling that says that Coastal GasLink can proceed with their building of a natural gas pipeline on the traditional territories of the Wet'suwet'en, the chiefs are saying they are not giving up that easily. And in fact, they gave eviction notices to Coastal GasLink last weekend. Credit where credit is due, they seem to have taken it with aplomb. It seems like the real agitator in all this, and this was sort of an overlooked story over Christmas, but The Guardian got a hold of notes from a meeting of the RCMP that this time last year, when the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chiefs and their allies and supporters were blocking access to this road to get to the construction site, that the RCMP apparently had shoot-to-kill orders with, like, snipers?
I believe it's called lethal overwatch mode, in which...
Which doesn't make it sound better!
If it seems like... Now, these are obviously traditional indigenous people, and they do hunt. I'm not sure if they had in the back of their minds it could possibly be an Oka situation, which was armed protesters. This, by all accounts, has not been.
No.
And that was a shocker. What's even more shocking is that it took a UK news outlet to find that out.
Yeah.
Or somebody working for them anyway.
It's part of a series of things. Like, because remember, it was Time magazine that broke the whole Trudeau blackface thing.
Yeah. And you have to wonder, you were talking about media earlier in the Australia story. It's like, we have to wonder here whether there's some of that going on as well, whether the resources have been beaten back or... Because all the reporting on that, something that had happened at that blockade, if I understand it right, was that they're somehow able to take out the internet, phones go down, they're able to drop like a tech bomb on it so that nothing
works. They block media access to the site too.
Even though there was some, I guess, well, let's call it more conventional, just probably somebody on their phone or device taking a film that comes out later. But there's no live tweeting of anything. They have the ability to do that. So that immediately shuts the story down. Well, not immediately, because it does get out eventually. And if I understand it right, so they had issued that injunction is the Wet'suwet'en for the construction people to get out. But I saw a report on, I think it was in Reuters on Tuesday, that said construction has started up again.
Mm-hmm.
And CBC had reported that the company, what is the company again? Coastal GasLink.
Yeah.
Will be or have sought a 72-hour injunction. So I guess the workers left. They get the proper paperwork in order, and it sounds like that will either expire on or just after Friday. So tomorrow or sometime on the weekend, there may be some more action here. So all of that came and went. It's not over, obviously, within a week. But then in researching this a bit, I didn't realize, and maybe you knew this too, that there's I don't know if it's a conflict directly between the hereditary chiefs and the band councils, but I saw that I visited a website. I wouldn't say it was weird, but it was, what was it called? First Nations Natural Gas Supporters or something like that, and had the list of people who have signed on to this. And I was like, wow, there's some real like internal conflict going on here that we don't necessarily hear about, and that they're touting it as like, oh, this is jobs for our people. But I went to the jobs list. It's all in Kitimat. So some of this pipeline is very long. You could be hundreds of kilometers away, and it's like, but your job is in Kitimat. So to tout the jobs angle is a bit, you know, not a red herring, but it's not like you, it sounds like you probably won't be able to stay in your community if you want to work on the pipeline. Now, the build of the pipeline will create jobs in the short term. Okay, it's all done. Then what?
That's sort of the traditional line for these projects, is that it's going to create jobs. Like, why are you standing in the way of jobs? And that was certainly the point of view of the Liberal leader in BC, Andrew Wilkman, who was, you know, went on the record to say, like, hey, where's John Horgan? Where's the premier? So that we can get, like, get these jobs going. Come on.
So it's not a clear cut.
I had read the thing that about, you know, the Liberal leader was calling out John Horgan. I was like, oh, is the Liberal leader on the side of the hereditary chiefs on this? No, he was on the side of jobs. But it was just for a minute
that's
there.
That's not surprised, because the Liberal Party
I wasn't surprised. I was surprised if he had been, but I mean, that's another story. But the thing that, you're right, that is the interesting angle on this, is that the band councils, all 20 of them along this line, are in favor of moving forward. You have the BC government, you have the federal government, and you have the elected band councils all lined up, ready to go on this. The people standing in the way are the hereditary chiefs. And I think that's the difficult question at the heart of all this. And how far does reconciliation go? Is it enough to have the elected representatives of the First Nation be satisfied, or do you have to make sure you get absolutely everyone in authority in the First Nation on board before you can proceed? And from the sound of it, these chiefs are not going to give up. They do not want this at all.
No.
And so that leaves, you know, leaving aside like the RCMP response, which was like dangerously over the top and really...
Yeah, because one of the comments was, use as much violence towards the gate as you want.
Yes!
So that's their way of saying, if you have to kill these people, just get them out of the way, because we need to build this pipeline. And that is, I was going to say it's a conflict of interest, but okay, so you've got our national police force enforcing corporate requests.
Yeah.
Up to the point that you're going to kill people, potentially, although thankfully it didn't happen.
Well, what's
some people were roughhoused for sure and hauled in.
Right.
This is the story. It's how does that go for a reconciliation?
My question is, was it at the corporate request, or did they just immediately go to the most extreme reaction possible? Well, because Coastal GasLink doesn't want to be tied to a massacre.
The police will say, well, we're just enforcing an injunction.
Right.
They were in military gear.
They were,
it's not the Red Surge. It's not they're going up in the red uniform.
No.
Okay, please get out of the way. The good workers have to get through.
This was
like soldiers.
It wasn't Dudley Doolittle and Paul What's-His-Face from Due South. It was, you know, they were suited and booted.
Yeah.
And
busting down the barricade. I mean, that is different, right? That is different.
And then you had Bill Blair saying, like, He said he raised concerns with the RCMP about the, quote, unacceptable words and phrases. And it's like, that's your concern, is the language? Are you concerned about the way they talked about maybe having to respond to these Indigenous protesters? Or are you concerned about the fact that these guys sounded like they were probably, in their parlance, ready to kill some Indians?
Yeah.
And that's another question that really needs answered.
Yeah, because what does that say to everyone? I mean, not just the First Nations and Indigenous people. It's like, okay, we are willing, on a corporate level, and it is, that's what it boils down to, mm-hmm. to just kill people, literally kill people, mm-hmm. so these workers can do their jobs, and create mm-hmm. wealth. That's like, something is very wrong. That how many lines in the reconciliation agreement does that violate? Probably all right. of them.
Okay. Well, the chiefs, they had a press conference and they said, like, the world is watching, the UN is watching. I mean, I know there are a lot of crackpots out there that hear the words the UN is watching and probably don't like the sound of that. But oh, yeah. at the same time,
Reddit lights
one
up.
One of the easiest things in the world for the government to do in terms of, like, getting that... checking off that list would be to sign on to the UN Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People. But of course, this kind of thing makes that really hard, because at the end of the day, it looks like somebody's going to have to get stepped on for this to go forward. And it looks like it's going to be the hereditary chiefs. And this is what I mean when I said at the top of the show, like, what are the limits of reconciliation? Where can you reconcile when you have 90% of the Indigenous people behind a course of action, 95%?
Because yeah, because you would think something like a classic referendum, or referenda in this case, would do it. But yeah, that is the great question that remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. A lot they're going to default to the chiefs to some degree, but yeah, it's a very interesting situation.
Well, we'll see. We'll have to see how it ends on the weekend, because we have to wrap up the show. Sadly, we are getting some special guests in over the next couple of weeks. We'll have Dominique O'Rourke, Ward 6 counselor, here next week. And we will have returning champion Mike Schreiner, the Guelph MPP. He'll be here on January 23rd.
We'll have his fight music ready. Rocky or Rocky 2 or something.
Anyway, stay tuned for that. If you want to listen to the show again, you can find us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. You can get this show every Monday at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog on occasion at spannerbrook.wordpress.com. And I'll just mention that the 5440 tickets are gone. Mm-hmm. Congratulations to our winners.
Yep.
We might see you there. Maybe. I might.
Yeah, you won't see me there.
Adam there. Stay tuned. I'm going to give a full report.
Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we'll see you then.